happen. So let's take an example. Hotel room. You got some work to do. You forgot to do your banking, which happens from time to time. And so you go, well, I'm on a network. It's a hotel. It's protected. Let me just log on to Chase or Bank of America and do that transfer or deposit. Now, someone could be next door with a free piece of software that could be, and the word they use is sniffing, they're really checking out what's being transmitted on that network. And if you're not doing your due diligence to keep yourself secure, the hotel isn't either. And what that's going to mean is that they're going to see everything that you type in, including a username, a password, the site you're going on, and that is just an open door to giving away all of your information. It's easily protectable, but it's something we're not aware of. Now, the part of the issue for a lot of people is, well, the bank site is secure. You see that S at the top of the web page. You see the little padlock, and those are really good things because that means there is encryption there. But the problem might not necessarily be that banking, but it might have been going on to a Gmail or a Facebook or another site where you use a password, and because we don't protect our passwords properly, and because, and we can talk about this later, we tend to reuse them over and over again. You know, once they find out that that harmless password you have for Amazon, as an example, I'm not saying that's not a good place to go, but if they get that, the first thing that they're going to try to do is test it against other services that used on Facebook. Is that your Gmail access? Which bank does he or she use? And maybe we'll try it there. I mean, a little bit of information and a little bit of elbow grease can go an awful long way in being able to have you with an open door to them.
Well, I'm raising my hand because I'm a little guilty of that, because you have so many places where you sign in. It just gets hard to keep up with all of it. So you do something that you can remember. Otherwise, you're forever resetting that password. And
indeed.
So, yes,
and you
I'm
know
guilty.
All the frustration that you have when a boss or an IT person says, you have to change your password every 2 weeks, and you have to use special characters, and you don't want to use a common word. Well, all that is for good reason, because that password hacking is one of the ways that they're going to take a harmless interception of information and then, okay, well, let's see how else she's using that. So my question to you, Giovanna, and to your listeners is, have you considered using a password manager to give yourself a higher level of protection when you're on the road?
I was keeping them in a place, but not probably where I should have been keeping them. But what are those tools that we can use to protect our data?
No, a basic password manager, which is sort of different than the data protection, but is the same conversation, allows you to have all your passwords stored, and they can all be different, and in fact should all be different. And all you then need to remember is a really, really difficult to crack master password. Now understand, you know, I've been playing on the internet as long as anybody else has, and for a long time that just didn't make sense to me, because my thought process was, you know, if they get that password, then I'm sunk. Then they have all of my stuff. But enough security people out there again and again and again were advising to have that really sophisticated, difficult to crack master password. The funny part of the situation is that we tend to use, A, as you said, passwords you remember, but even more so, simple stuff. There's a list online that makes me laugh whenever I see it of the most commonly used passwords. And you know what the most commonly used password is?
Birth date.
It could be, but it's actually even easier than that. It's password.
The word password.
I mean, you would figure someone would change that right away, but a lot of people don't. So you get a password manager, and it comes in two varieties. Typically, it'll come either in a free or a pay. You know, it's the freemium model, which is very, very common with apps these days. I believe in using it on a pay basis because I want the full protection. The one I could in particular use, and I don't rep any of these companies, but the one I've ended up using for the past couple of years is an app and a service called Dashlane. And Dashlane gives me protection to up to 3 devices. So I have it on my computer, I have it on my phone, I have it on my tablet.
How are we spelling that?
Great question. D-A-S-H as in Dash, and Lane as in Lois Lane. But Dashlane allows you to have that master password and then have everything protected. But at the same time, when you go onto a website, if you've logged into Dashlane and if you put in the proper master password, it'll automatically log you into the site, which is really, really cool and important. I mean, just being at home alone, just to have that level of peace of mind and security. But when you're on your mobile devices, and you know how frustrating it is, oh, what password did I use for that? It'll make sure that all of that is encrypted and is hidden so that that password becomes much more secure, and the fact that you're not reusing them over and over and over again. So if I, as the hacker, found that one site that you logged into, it doesn't match anything else. Huge level of security and protection. But the password manager alone is not going to protect you. It's really a multiple-step process, and especially from the road, perhaps even more important than the password manager is the personal VPN, which stands for Virtual Private Network. Organizations have this with their team oftentimes when they're on the road, but we might forget to put it onto our phone or put it onto our mobile device. And in essence, what a VPN does is it protects you from local snooping. It protects you from the people next door or sitting next to you at the coffee shop from getting that information that you've typed in and being able to see it. It creates a tunnel, as it were, from where you're sitting to the servers out in, call it server land, wherever those servers might be, and it gets away from that local prying and snooping, especially for the folks who travel a lot. This is a critical because that type of attack, which is known as a man-in-the-middle attack, and essentially what happens is a person sets up their computer, and let's say it's the Bob's coffee shop that we're both having a cup of Joe in, and all of a sudden this person sets up their computer to be in between the Wi-Fi and your computer. And so when you log in, you're actually going through his or her computer first, and hence the name man in the middle. That person's in the middle between you and the internet. And they can see everything that you're putting in there, except if you have it encrypted in a tunnel. So hence a service such as a VPN, and there are a number for personal use. I use one that's called Tunnel Bear. Easy VPN is out there. There are a bunch that do this, will allow you either for free or for a fee, give you that peace of mind of being able to make sure that your connections are encrypted and hidden away from the local prying eyes.
So we've gotten a couple of things that we really need to do pretty much before you leave, which is to get the VPN, to get that protection for yourself, as well as
if you get a good professional password manager, they will set the password for you. You can click one button and scramble all your passwords. Now, I know, again, counterintuitive. What do you mean I don't know what my passwords are? But if you don't know them and you can't remember them and they're a combination of letters and numbers and all sorts of weird characters, then guess what? The person trying to hack in is probably going to go, I'm not going to try this computer. I'll try another one.
Such a great idea, because you're getting something that's completely random, that's not going to be associated with you. And so it's not something that somebody can just think about from just Googling basic information on you, like your date of birth or your anniversary or something of that nature.
Spouse name, child name, pet's name, all those are common fodder. And if you know that little piece of information about the person, you know, those are the first places they're going. Then where they're going, believe it or not, is to a piece of software. And these are called dictionary attacks, where the hacker will buy a dictionary of, let's say, 250,000 words, commonly used words, and they'll just have the computer try every single one of them. So if it's a word that's a common word, which is why your IT folks want you to put letters and numbers and special characters in there, then they'll be able to hack it with a $5 download.
And I also want to say, some people may be thinking, well, I don't conduct anything like that on there. I don't have a lot of things on my phone, but you're still vulnerable if you're using your phone and your data in any way.
Absolutely correct. In fact, one of the terms that's very, very hot these days is the term social engineering. And in essence, what that means is these malicious attacks are inflicted by getting you to give up your information. How is that done? It could be something as simple as a link to click or a trusted email that you got that they send to you because you saw the name of the person, it was your brother or your friend, and you click on it. Or they sort of ask you for the information. It's amazing how easy sometimes it is for them to get us to give up information that we normally wouldn't give to anyone just by being tricky, by asking a few questions, or by attempting to even be genuine. So we have to have, as we travel, our defenses up at all times.
Is there anything you should look out for when you get back?
I would always look out to see if you go onto a website and it redirects you to somewhere that you shouldn't have gone or you didn't put in the URL, because that is a clear sign of some sort of malicious ware that's on your computer. So if I go to Google and it redirects me to Yahoo, not that Yahoo is doing it, or it redirects me to another search engine, that's a huge red flag. And immediately what I would do, and this is another tool that we're going to talk about right now, is to make sure that the user has not only antivirus software, which these days I think is pretty standard. Everyone knows they need to have that, but an anti-malware solution, malware as in malicious ware. And this will catch things that aren't viruses, but that by clicking on the wrong link can infect your computer. Again, free and premium. You have both approaches. I'd rather stay with the premium, but for $15 a year, $20 a year, I can get a program such as Malware Bytes, spelled with B-Y-T-E-S. I can have it always running on my computer. So if I go to that site that accidentally can drive by and give me a payload or a malicious piece of software on my computer, it'll block it, it'll quarantine it, and it'll never get into my system.
Okay, so in some very basic layman terms, what is the difference between a virus and malware?
Well, a virus is a code that not only infects a computer, but continues to reproduce itself and spread to other computers. Malware, which actually has it, they have malware and spyware, is a malicious code that's in there. It's not going to spread, but it's intended to do damage on your computer. The idea of the virus, like everyone's favorite Nigerian uncle who we have, where we're getting the thousands of dollars that's being left for us in a bank, those are viruses that if you click on that link, you can not only infect yourself, but infect other people. And in addition to that, you understand that if you get an email that's coming from somebody else that you know, but it doesn't seem to make sense, that's a virus that's in there. And by clicking on the link that's there, you infect your computer, and then it sends out the information to all of the people in your contact list.
It's so amazing. And I tell you one tip that I do, because if I'm not sure if it's valid, let's say it does come from a friend or what you think is a friend of yours, of email that you're familiar with, I don't click on anything. I don't open anything. What I do is just move my mouse over top of it and see what the URL is.
Great, great thing to do. I would take it a step further, because sometimes that URL is so tricky that it might look good, but it isn't. For example, if I get a link to a YouTube video from somebody and it has a generic, it has my name in there and it says, you got to watch this. I never click on it. But what I might do is send that person a note, not just replying to the email saying, did you just send me something? Did you just send me a link? Because if they say no, then I know that's a virus or a piece of malware that's trying to get into my computer, but it requires that click on the link for me to be able to open my back door.
And then, of course, those that I am getting more frequently is to say that there is something with your account, or that you've been locked out of your bank account or credit card account, or they need you to verify something.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm sure we're all getting those.
More and more. Those are called phishing scams, and phishing with a P-H. And they are so easy. I mean, even if 0.1% of the people ever clicks on it, they've opened the door to get whatever they want to do, whether it's creating havoc on your computer, spreading it to other computers, getting your personal information. But, you know, a bank, a major institution won't send you an email to tell you that you need to update your account. It just doesn't happen. They know those tricks. So anytime we get that, we should be really aware of where it's coming from and what they're asking for. You know, and if a bank says we've had a problem with some sort of infection, or maybe something got in their system, my first approach would be to call the bank. I know it's old-fashioned, but, you know, I'm going to give them a call, say, did you just send this out? Do I really need to be concerned about this?
Let's just do a quick recap on the dangers that lurk, what tools you should have, and those steps that you should take.
I think the two-step approach that's mandatory is the password manager and the VPN, the virtual private network. Those should be set up beforehand across all of your devices to make sure that you are much more resistant to any attacks. In addition to that, a piece of anti-malware is a good approach that even if something does get through, that your computer, your device can block it before it does any damage.
Great. You were named one of the hospitality industry's trendsetters in 2015 for technology education. So what are some of these new tech tips for traveling that you can share with us?
There's so many cool ones out there. Here are a couple of my recent faves. Hopper, which is a fare prediction tool and gotten some real good feedback as sort of the best tool of late 2015, 2016, allows me to put in the destination I'm going to and where I am coming from, and it'll monitor and track the fares and let me know when they're expected to go up or down or have the best point where I can buy it. Love that. Easy, free of charge, simple to use. For business travelers, but especially for their admins, there's a new service. It's not an app right now, but it's called Travo, T-R-A-V-O.com. That is really allowing a business person who has multiple meetings for the admin to go in and to identify the locations of the meetings and where they're flying to and from, and it'll create an itinerary that optimizes the time and location and when they need to leave and which hotel's most adjacent to where they have to be. It's a pretty cool approach to really help the business traveler and their admin manage the travel process and make sure they optimize their time. I also heard about recently It's Easy, which is an app that allows for passport renewal straight from your mobile phone.
Well, I'll have to check that one out. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining me today and helping us to keep our digital data safe when we travel.
Javon, thank you so much for having me.
There are few things worse in the travel world than watching the luggage carousel go around and around, and then you're the last person standing with no luggage to be found. Has that ever happened to you? If so, what did you do? And do you know what you're entitled to? This sounds like a case for Mo.
Traveling Culturati with your girl Mo, always on the go. And I'm here with
Yasmin.
When you fly, has the airline ever lost your luggage?
No.
But hypothetically speaking, if the airlines lost your luggage, what would you do?
I would go crazy.
Go crazy. Okay, go crazy how?
I would probably curse at them. I would get, like, pretty heated, get pretty mad.
Did you know that the airlines actually have an entitlement to you if they lose your luggage?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay, well, you stay tuned in. We're going to let you know what you're entitled to if they ever lose your luggage.
Okay.
Traveling Culturati with your girl, Mo, always on the go. And I have...
Badon.
Has the airline ever lost your luggage?
No, they haven't.
Let's speak hypothetically. If the airline did lose your luggage, what would you do?
I'd probably be a little upset. I'd probably go up to them and get a little angry.
Get a little angry.
Raise my voice a little bit.
Oh, okay, raise your voice a little bit, okay. All right, so after you do that, do you know what you may be entitled to? Like, would you be raising your voice to prove a point or to get something from the situation?
More to prove a point for me, because if I'm going somewhere, most of the time it's for a couple days, and I don't got time to be looking for some clothes that I already brought with me.
Brother, I hear that. Okay, there is a couple of things that you are entitled to if they lose your luggage, but keep listening and we'll let you know what it is, okay?
Sounds good.
Traveling Culturati with your girl Mo, always on the go, and I am here with
Nick.
When you fly, has the airlines ever lost your luggage?
No.
Hypothetically speaking, if they ever lost your luggage, what would you do?
I'd have to call the airlines. You know, they have like the lost baggage thing, so I have to go call them up. Get back.
Do you know what they're entitled to give you when you call?
I'd assume that your luggage, that they have to give that back to you.
Okay, what if they permanently lose your luggage?
I think you're hosed.
Okay, hosed.
Yeah, you're not getting it. I'm getting anything. Maybe if they're nice, they'll give you like a voucher.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you the correct answer on what you're entitled to, just in case they lose your luggage.
Yeah, that's fine. I'd like to know.
The one thing that is clear is if you lose someone's luggage, they tend to become irate. But it seems as if no one knows what they are entitled to if the airline does lose their luggage. Traveling Culturati with your girl, Mo. Always on the go. Back to you, Javon.
Thanks, Mo. The somewhat good news is that a lost bag is rare. Most bags that don't arrive on that carousel when they're supposed to are just delayed. With that being said, most airlines will only cover $50 per day for delayed baggage. However, you can always ask for more. As for the lost or damaged luggage, the Department of Transportation issued a directive in 2009 to domestic airlines that are to cover all reasonable, actual, and verifiable expenses related to baggage loss, damage, or delay, up to $3,300. If the airline doesn't comply, you can file a complaint with the Department of Transportation. Also, be sure to ask the airline about getting your checked bag fee reimbursed. Here are some helpful tips. The only way to avoid a lost, delayed, or damaged bag is not to check it at all. If you must, the best way to minimize this occurrence is to travel nonstop. Make sure there is a luggage tag in your bag and on the outside of the bag. And get traveler's insurance that includes baggage insurance. When we come back, I've got the Culture Report. I'm Javon Harley with the Traveling Culturati on HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. Culturati host and travel pro Javon Harley. The 2016 WHUR World Tour takes us to Japan, a country steeped in tradition and culture, from the ultra-modern bullet trains to the incomparable shopping in Tokyo. Culturati will love it. This November 3rd through the 12th, we'll visit Tokyo, Kyoto, and Osaka. We'll stay in deluxe five-star hotel accommodations and enjoy excellent tours and cuisine. Sponsored by the Japan National Tourism Organization, United Airlines, and WHUR. The WHUR World Tour, Japan. Visit advantage-intl.com for details. As the continent's leading airline, South African Airways, a Star Alliance member, knows Africa better than any other airline. We are Africa's most awarded airline, which includes a 4-star rating from Skytrax for 14 consecutive years and named Best Airline for Africa for 13 consecutive years. With our daily service from Washington Dulles to Johannesburg and beyond, from the moment you board, you'll see we're the only way to fly to Africa. To book your flight, visit us online at flysaa.com. FlySAA.com. Devon Harley here, your travel pro and host of Traveling Culturati, with the top reasons to visit Ghana: history, friendly people, Ghanaian hospitality, and unsurpassed natural beauty. Ghana has it all, but the top reason to visit Ghana is to join me and Advantage International. The wait is over. The dates are set. Join us in Ghana September 8th through the 16th. We'll start in the capital city of Accra and visit the W.E.B. Du Bois Center for Pan-African Culture. We'll follow the history of the slave trade and visit the infamous forts, castles, and slave dungeons on the Elmina and Cape Coast, September 8th through the
16th. Hi, I'm Hoda Kotb from NBC's Today Show. I am so excited to let you know that I have my very own exclusive show on Today Show Radio on Sirius XM. After you listen to Kathy Lee and Hoda talk to me about it, we're going to talk music, tech, exercise, nutrition, relationships, and celebs. This show is going to be so much fun. We're going to get to know each other. Join me, Hoda Kotb, for The Hoda Show, Mondays and Wednesdays, 2 p.m. East on Today Show Radio, Sirius XM 108.
America's wounded warriors are coming home. After serving on foreign shores, these brave men and women are returning to their families and communities. Many have wounds you can see, and many have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. Now that these warriors are back home, they are ready to enter the civilian workforce. To help, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These extraordinary men and women bring proven world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork to the job. And to ensure the right warrior finds the right job, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right match. When you hire a wounded warrior, you hire an intelligent, talented, and committed new employee. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by: never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal: we leave no warrior behind. Wounded Warrior Project is a nonprofit organization created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war. Whether those scars are physical or mental, we're here to make sure that they heal. And whether it's helping those with post-traumatic stress disorder live a normal life again, or giving much-needed support to injured warriors and veterans hospitals, because no one deserves our help more than the men and women who risk their lives to keep us safe. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
If you'd like to stay connected, this is your personal invitation to join me tonight. Hi, I'm Lorna Newton. The connection's on from 8 till midnight, and the only thing missing is you. We've got all the music you love to hear, you love to relax to, you love to tap your toes to. We'll do it all just for you. The Connection, right here on HUR Voices, on SiriusXM. That's 8 o'clock tonight, Eastern Standard Time. Bring a friend along.
Progressively interactive, HURvoices.com.
Welcome back to the Traveling Culturati. I'm your host, Javon Harley, and I'm also your travel pro, but time is running out. That's to join me to Ghana, September 8th through the 16th. We have a few seats left, but there's very little time, so head on over to the website to get the details and to make your reservation, and that's travelingculturati.com, and while you're there, join the travel club. Well, you know what time it is right now? It's time for the Culture Report. And this week takes us to one of my all-time favorite destinations, and that's Jamaica. There's a Jamaica that most tourists don't really get to see. It's the true culture of Jamaica. And chatting with me today is Mark McDermott, who is the Business Development Manager for the Midwest USA with the Jamaican Tourist Board. Hello, Mark. How are you today?
Hi, Javon. I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining me to talk about such an exciting destination, one that is my all-time favorite. Where do you start with a culture that permeates the heart and soul of the people and resonates in everything they do? I guess there's no better place to start than with the people.
Absolutely. And what a people. The original Jamaicans were the Taino Indians who farmed and fished and lived a very simple life. Next came the Spaniards with Christopher Columbus's arrival in 1494. Christopher Columbus thought the island was rich in gold, and he immediately set the peaceful Tainos to mine for this gold. They quickly died out, though, because they were not accustomed to hard labor nor the European diseases that were influenced because of the arrival. We unfortunately have no traces left of those really wonderful people. During that time, slavery was started in the way of sugar cultivation. With the British coming in after the Spaniards, the British came in 1655 and fought and drove the Spaniards out of Jamaica by 1658. And the British were the ones who really went to town with the sugar plantations and needed labor, brought in the Africans, mostly from West Africa, for the plantations. Started a really dark past for most Jamaicans. Slavery was abolished, though, in 1838. Indentured laborers were brought in from China and from India. By indentured laborers, they worked mostly for goods and kind rather than cash. But they brought with them the influences of the East. And so today, Jamaica reflects Spanish ancestry, our British ancestry, our native and Chinese and Indian ancestry, but largely our African ancestry, because we're 98% of African origin in the island.
There are so many island flavors. What are some of them?
The national dish, which most people don't realize, is ackee and salted codfish. Ackee, which came through from Western Africa too, and codfish, which was a staple serve. And these are the things that they've come through the throes of our The plantation workers were fed salted cod because this is what the British thought was an economical way of feeding the workers. Ackee is our national fruit, which is a bland fruit, which if it's not open on the tree, can be poisonous because it needs to release the poisonous gases. So it's a combination of a bland fruit and salted collect, very well seasoned and teamed with festival or fried Johnny cakes or roasted breadfruit, and is mostly a breakfast food, but can be had as lunch or dinner or as you see fit.
You mentioned some things, and I just want to make sure we know what they are. Festival. What is festival?
Festival is a deep-fried bread. It's made from flour, cornmeal, coconut, and may have some spices.
Okay, well, now let's get back to the jerk chick.
History of jerk. During Jamaica's past, there were what were known as the Maroons, who didn't think standard life should be being ruled by the British, so fled the plantations and took refuge in the hills, and they made systemic attack on the British, so much so that the British had to give them their own treaty of emancipation, as it were. And to this day, there are freed people who have communities in the Portland East area of Jamaica and also in the central St. James near Montego Bay area of Jamaica. The Maroons used to cook wild boar. They would hunt the boars and they would cook the boars on pimento wood, which is a characteristic of jerk. It's flavored with pimento berries and, you know, all kinds of seasonings that were available then. They would marinate it for a few days and then they would slow cook it. The coals were made from pimento. A lattice work of pimento wood was made to put the meat on, and then it would be covered and submerged with pimento branches. The pimento branches, I think the foremost reason for the pimento branches was the fact that they didn't want the British to see the smoke rising. So it would have to be covered and slow cooked. But I think the advantage that came from that is that it was simmered, it was succulent. Most of the jerk specialists, like Scotchies, for example, who do it the traditional way, and these are modern restaurants that can be found all across Jamaica, but they do it the traditional way of cooking it on coals, putting it on slabs, and doing it the way that the Maroons did it.
You have to go out to a jerk pit when you're there and get the real stuff.
And Port Antonio, there's an area in Port Antonio called Boston Jerk. They have kept the traditions, and therefore they do it the way that it was passed down from the Maroons in Moortown, in that region.
The sounds of Jamaica, I mean, they can be heard around the world, mostly in one form. But what I love about Jamaican music, it was also an instrument of change, and it's very representative of Jamaica's roots. So when
Indeed.
You talk about those sounds of Jamaica.
A lot of what we are, who we are, came from the plantations, and nothing speaks more to that than the music. Reggae, in its current form, it has gone through a lot of changes. On the plantation, there were a lot of things happening. The plantation workers used to mimic what they saw coming in from the British influence, but they also brought in a lot of their African influences. Their African deities were brought in, their African forms of worship were brought in, and this is where the music got its greatest support. You look at, for example, Dinky Mini. You look at Kumina. These are some of the forms that were brought in. Brockins is a direct reference to ballroom-style dancing, and so is quadrille. These are some of the earlier forms of our dance in Jamaica. Brockins and quadrille. With Brockins, there is a blue queen versus a red queen, and it's the warring of the royal bands. This came directly from the courts of England, but of course, the plantation workers added their own spice to it. They added their own music to it. And the form of music was mostly what was known as mento then. And even mento in itself draws from African and British musical instruments, Spanish musical instruments. Then you look at Kumina. Kumina is performed largely in the eastern Jamaica in an area called St. Thomas. This was brought in from Western Africa. It's a slow-moving, rhythmic shuffle of the feet. And it's so amazing to see the queen doing her rounds of shuffling with articulate arm movements and grace and dramatic bearings. Again, from the plantation, but with mostly derived music called mento. If we look at reggae music as it is today, It's got its roots from the mento, which is string sounding and came largely from, you know, again, the plantations who the workers were celebrating during Christmas time. They were celebrating during their off time, and they would mostly use the instruments that were available to them, which would be a flute mostly and drums. Then after mento, we came to ska. Ska was the 50s-60s version of an up-tempo, a high-spirited mood in the music. And you have people like Bob Marley in his early days was a component of that movement. After ska, we kind of progressed into a slow movement called rock steady. I remember something that was known as rent a tile. Your mother and your father would, for the most of the night, be dancing so close that they rented the tile that they were standing on, and they wouldn't move because for the whole night they were there. So rock steady was that era of, I guess, an easy, very mellow kind of music. To today's very vibrant form of what we call dance hall. Dance hall music is more the synthesized modern elements that the Beanie Man, the Sean Paul, the Shabba Ranks have brought in. And with that, you know, comes a full celebration of all that's Jamaica. And it's basically mostly from the inner cities. They have pulled from the roots, but they have taken it forward in a more international, more holistic way.
We talked about the language, and you said something when we very first started the program about the language.
We, for many years, were told that when you spoke the dialect, you were to speak properly, meaning you were to speak English. But this Louise Bennett came about, and she did some really pioneering work in the 50s to encourage Jamaicans that, no, this is our language. This is ours. We weren't talking bad. We were speaking a language that came from Africa, a language called a tree. And some of our words came directly from tree, like, you know, bankra meaning basket, dotty meaning ground, nyam meaning to eat, and so on. And so she was saying that, no man, you must speak these words because these words are yours. So she brought this whole sense of no, speak Jamaican. And she is the one who spoke about tech. Bad thinking make laugh. We minimize these bad situations and we laugh about them because that's how we got going. That was what helped us on the plantation. And to this day, in mitigating circumstances, I spoke about nyam. That's a word that's in Jamaican. It means to eat. Irie. That's a word that didn't necessarily come from our past, but it was brought on by the Rastafarian culture. Irie means all is well, all is good, all is fine. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. That's it for the show today, but I'll be back next week. And remember, wherever you go, go with all your heart. Confucius. To find out more about the Traveling Culturati, visit the website at travelingculturati.com. Follow and share with me on social media and join the Travel Club. Special thanks to studio producer Brittany Riddle, video producer Howard Little, executive producer Gene Harley, and to you, thanks for tuning in. I'm Javon Harley with the Traveling Culturati exclusively on HUR Voices.
You've been listening to the Traveling Culturati with travel pro Javon Harley. Tune in next week at the same time on HUR Voices.
The Howard University Radio Network is W.